Welcome back to Dave's Gone By on AM 1240 WGBB Freeport and AM 1240 WGBB.com. Segment I like to call Dave's Got Guests. Well, one guest anyway, very special guest, friend of my wife's for quite a few years now, a friend of mine too. Her name is Diditi Mitra, and she's been in this country since 1986, originally from Calcutta, and so has a some rather interesting memories to share about her growing up in India, and also about a culture that we kind of take for granted in this country and often make fun of, at least if you're Jackie Mason, the whole Indian cab driver thing. We have this set batch of stereotypes, and yet we rely on them to get us around, and we see them everywhere and see them eating in, little Indian restaurants just as they jump into their cabs and change gas, but, there's a whole real life and real people behind that, and hopefully we'll get a glimpse into that culture from our friend Diditi. So, Diditi Mitra, welcome to Dave's Gone By.
Thank you.
So, again, you came to this country in 86, but until then you were in Calcutta, that's where you were born?
Yeah, I've born and lived all my life in Calcutta, yep.
So, what are your earliest memories of growing up there?
Some of my memories are just hanging around in the neighborhood growing up as a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And, making friends in the neighborhood and hanging out with them and sometimes lying to my parents, going out to the movies without telling them.
I assume this was not when you were 4 years old.
No, not when I was four. No, but I was like, 12. I was in eighth grade, remember?
Well, there's actually, Indian movies are coming into some kind of renaissance now. We're seeing more and more, that's happening. What do you love Indian cinema?
Yes, I love the Hindi movies with all its problems. I love them because they are, I think, escapist in a lot of ways. And the Hindi music, which is part of the cinema,
mm-hmm.
is really what a lot of people listen to. So now it's changing a little bit because with pop music and non-film music becoming part of the mainstream. But in terms of mainstream songs, I think that's where a lot of the songs come from. So I do enjoy it, and it's colorful and most of it is a little escapist. It can get a little boring, but
mm-hmm.
I do like it.
There was a scene, I didn't see the whole movie, but early in The Guru, you see the little kid, he's watching one, basic classic type Indian musical, and he sneaks over to another cinema in the multiplex, and he watches Grease with John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John with the Hindi subtitles instead. Did you have some of that growing up? Was there like the thrill of an American movie coming through also, and were they significantly different?
Oh yeah, I mean, I do remember seeing Grease when I was, I think, I don't know, 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
I did see that Grease with Olivia Newton-John and John Travolta, and that's also a very class thing where those in the middle and upper classes watch Hollywood movies too. I mean, I also remember watching with my father a lot of the westerns with Yul Brynner and Magnificent Seven. And
were they dubbed or just subtitled?
No, they were in English. They were not subtitled.
Oh. So at what point were you taught English just naturally in like elementary school or?
No, I was taught English. 2.5, 3 years old.
In school?
Yeah, in school. So I learned English pretty early. So it's something that, I learned simultaneously with other languages.
Was there any kind of resentment of that being still part of the whole English caste, and, well, not caste system, but certainly the whole English colonial system, the holdover of that? Or was it just very natural for most people in India to speak English as well as their dialect?
Well, I mean, with the English, again, there's a class element to it, too, where in the middle and upper classes generally tend to speak English and tend to value English as and have all these meanings attached to English as, a much more polished way of speaking, or, much more people who speak English and wear jeans and pants are just more sophisticated.
Hmm.
And so there are those influences that are still very dominant and very much part of the culture in India, at least the urban, middle, and the upper classes. So in terms of resentment, no, I remember, I mean, now I feel a little foolish growing up, publicly speaking English to make myself to make myself look so good and superior in front of those who did not speak English. So that was, when I think back to that and I realize that how much of an influence the past continues to have on the present. And so, no, there was no resentment, certainly not.
And when you came over here, first of all, what was the reasoning behind it, and was there a big culture shock for you? Did you come right to New York, or how did that all come about?
I actually had come to visit in the summer months of 86 with my parents, my aunt who was living in Richmond Hill, Queens, since 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And I had plans on coming here as a student, as most of the urban upper middle class people do, and, you know, going and studying abroad, so I was certainly had one of those goals, especially with my aunt being here. And I had taken this test called the Test of English Language as a Foreign Language called TOEFL the year before,
mm-hmm.
because I was in 11th grade, and I was like, okay, it's time to apply for colleges. And I just happened to visit, and I had my TOEFL scores with me, and my aunt said, well, since you're here and you've taken the TOEFL, well, why don't we go see if you can get into high school? And Christ the King Regional High School, which is where I met Joyce, actually.
Joyce, my wife.
Yes, and that's where you know, I started school, and my aunt just said, just stay here. They admitted me in the fall of 86, 12th grade, and I stayed on. So that's how it all started.
And you lived with your aunt for a few years until, I guess, college years, or?
Yeah, till 91, since I finished college, and then I moved to New Brunswick, to Rutgers. I was there till 94, and then I moved to Philadelphia to go to Temple from 94 to...
Temple being Temple University, not being converted to Judaism and rushed to a synagogue in Philadelphia. Yeah.
No, certainly not. And then in 2002 is when I finished my degree, and now I'm living in Jersey again.
I'm loving it.
Oh, yes, definitely.
So what was the biggest appreciable difference for you? I mean, you were young, high school age, when you made the real switch. But between Indian life, city Indian life, you were urban, mm-hmm. and America, Queens, New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that helped was knowing the language, but I did not necessarily understand the accent. So I remember that being a fear. It was almost as if I didn't know the language. So that was one thing. So I wouldn't answer telephones because I didn't know what the person on the other side would be saying because I didn't understand the language. I was fearful of the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
So that, of course, over a while I got over it.
Okay, tell the eraser story.
The eraser story, yes. That was one other story. Well, I was in school. It was an art class. And in India... erasers called a rubber, and we were sitting around, and I don't know, Joyce happened to be there. I know she wasn't in class. I don't know why she was there. She was sitting next to me and asked her for a rubber. And she understood what I meant.
Yeah.
And so she said, well, why don't you ask Laura? Laura was sitting way across from the table, and I'm very lazy, so instead of getting up and walking over to her and asking her for a rubber,
oh God,
I just happened to yell it across the table, and I rubber, and Laura looks at me in a strange way, and Joyce Ann is sitting next to me, smirking.
Smirking. Knowing my wife, she was probably laughing, you know, hysterically.
She was like, oh my God, I got her in trouble. And that was certainly the purpose. And
did Laura give you a rubber?
She said for later, baby, but not right now.
Oh, man. All right, I want to take the second half of this interview.
Okay.
And talk about, you have your doctorate, by the way. Congratulations.
Thank you.
A lovely doctorate from Temple?
Yes.
In
sociology.
Sociology, which is what my wife is getting her doctorate in as well, yes. Over at Fordham. What was your dissertation on?
I researched Indian taxi drivers in New York City.
And specifically, was there something you were trying to find out about them, or was it just a slice of their lives?
No, I was actually trying to find out why they drive taxis in New York City, what were some of the factors that led them to you know,
and,
do that.
And what did you discover?
Well, there were a few things. I looked at the relationships that they had with the other Indian taxi drivers, or other taxi drivers in general, and found out that most of their relationships were with other Indian taxi drivers, or were taxi drivers at one point, or planned to be. And I looked at... the ways that the fleet garages in the city,
mm-hmm.
fleet garages are places where the drivers go to lease their taxis. The drivers are independent contractors, and they lease their taxis for, at the time, this was in the summer of 2000, anywhere the lease was from $80 to $110 that they have to pay up front. So I talked to the managers and owners of those fleet garages, find out what they were doing that increased the proportion of Indian drivers in the city, because there was a very high proportion of Indian taxi drivers in New York City, which was the reason why I wanted to explore the topic. So I looked at the owners of the garages, and I looked at changes in the patterns of Indian immigration to the United States, particularly in the last 20 to 30 years.
Has it grown exponentially?
Yes. It changes in terms of the socioeconomic background of the immigrants who are coming to the United States. So particularly since 1960s to 2000, how that has changed and whether that had anything to do with the high proportion of taxi drivers we see in the city.
You can say, well, a taxi, you can get, as long as you have a driver's license, you get a hack license, and then it's a job that you can get, you know, seemingly. I assume that's part of it when immigrants are coming in. Mm-hmm. But there are other reasons why so many of them went for this profession rather than barber college, mm-hmm, or restaurants, or, you know, things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's an interesting question. When a lot of the taxi drivers, at least the ones that I interviewed, they were largely coming from rural backgrounds. They were primarily of farming background, of lower socioeconomic background, who did not really know English very well, but certainly had a grasp, somewhat of a grasp of the English language, so which made it easier for this group to opt for taxi, because then, you know, they could understand what the passenger was saying and take those tests,
right,
that he had to take the hack license. It's one of the things that is the easy thing to do. As you said, you know, you have a driver's license, and then all you have to do is take these exams. And they cost money, $400 to $500, I believe, to get a hack license. There's some fees. Restaurants is something that they may plan to do. So initially, because it takes a lot of capital to start a restaurant business. So, you know, once they drive cabs, their goal, at least for the sample, was to make enough money so that they could save up and then maybe in the future invest in restaurants or even buy gas stations or, you know, small grocery stores. So I think one of the reasons that they chose for taxi is one that, you know, the networks that they were coming into were already cab drivers. So the people that they were familiar with knew this industry really well and knew how to get their co-ethnic, their relatives or friends, into driving taxis.
Mm-hmm.
And two, it is a profession that does not require elaborate set of, a set of skills, you know, that does not require high levels of education. So even if somebody knows somewhat some English and can drive, they can do this job. It's a tough job, but it's something that is accessible in that way.
Did you hear, I mean, how large was your sample, by the way? How many people did you talk to?
The taxi drivers I spoke with, 40 Indian taxi drivers, 10 non-Indian taxi drivers, 8 owners or managers of garages, and 2 activists of the New York Taxi Workers Alliance. So about 60
folks. So have they... Were their experiences as a whole positive, or is it all a way station for them, or do they end up not really even making enough to put down enough money to go to the next level of the so-called American dream that they want, or are they sending a lot of money home to relatives and friends who are making, you know, $3 an hour, you know, out in Pakistan or in India?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, that's a good question. It's something that I think that future research needs to explore, that what happens to these people, are they really being able to save? But given the people that I talked with, to me it would seem like a difficult dream to achieve, given that a lot of them have to pay off their loans that they took out in order to migrate.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of money from relatives or other people. Secondly, the amount of money that my sample was making really was around maybe between $24,000 to $32,000 a year, and then they're supporting families.
Is that 24? You know, they're clearing that kind of money after whatever the.
Yeah. Well, they told me this is what they made in a week, so it also could be that they're also paying their leases out of the money that they're earning.
Right.
And
this is before or after their taxes?
After.
It was after taxes.
Yeah.
So somewhere in the 24 to 30 something range.
Yeah.
Were there any amazing anecdotes or stories that you were told about, you know, their experiences?
Well, I mean, not really. I mean, I know that the drivers, you know, are mugged, have the risk of that happening, being robbed.
Do they all hate police?
Actually, a good proportion of them talked about the kind of disrespect they receive from the police as well as the passengers. However, they also say, you know, there's good police, bad police, good police, good passenger, bad passenger. However, they have, they are a little afraid of the police in a way that they feel insulted whenever they violate traffic laws. They've been threatened with deportation. They have been cursed out by the police. They believe that they receive higher tickets as cab drivers and then as Indian cab drivers, that they feel that they're targets of racism by the police.
And you mentioned there's some kind of union happening?
Yeah, there's the New York Taxi Workers Alliance in Manhattan. They feel that the wages aren't sufficient. They, or at least in 2000, they felt that the wages weren't sufficient. And I know there's a push right now towards livable wage of taxi drivers. There's a petition that's going around for that. They also feel that the traffic laws are just too severe for them. They feel that the Taxi Limousine Commission gives them too many tickets, and that when the drivers go to contest those tickets, it's really no use because inevitably the drivers end up losing. And they feel that there are charges of, you know, racism as well that shape the experiences of the drivers.
Here's one thing that I actually don't know about. Like, you get into a New York City yellow cab. And it's like $2 during the day for a drop, or $2.50 at night, and then whatever else, whatever's on the meter plus tip. Mm-hmm. What goes to the cabbie? What goes to the owner? You know, the cab company.
Well, as you know, as independent contractors, they can't. They are not eligible for health benefits because they're not employers of the garages, for example, that they lease the taxis from. So they don't get that. They also have to pay the lease fee up front, usually. Mm. That's, as I said, at the time was between $80 and $110. They also have to pay for gasoline. They also have to, you know, pay for their food, of course.
Right, but in other words, of the money that the passenger mm-hmm. hands in mm-hmm. when the ride is over, mm-hmm. what percentage, and I assume they keep the whole tip, mm-hmm. but what about the actual drop money and the money of the wheel spinning? Mm-hmm. Does that all go elsewhere and they only keep the tip, or what's the deal with
that? No. They are just giving the garages the lease money, and they have to pay for gasoline. I think they have to return their taxis with a full tank, I believe. So.
Right, but other than that, they basically keep
the
whatever.
Rest, yes.
Oh, okay, I did not realize that.
Yes.
I gotcha. Okay, and then from that, they pay a certain fee to the a lease fee and the gas and all that.
Right.
Okay, and for maintenance and fix-it stuff?
No, if they're leasing it from the garage, then they don't have to take care of maintenance. However, some of the drivers that I spoke with also owned medallions.
Right.
And in that case, they're the owner of the cabs as well, and so then they have to take care of their maintenance stuff. But when they're leasing from the garages, no.
One last question. After having done that study and that dissertation, what was the one most surprising thing, if any, that you didn't realize, that you learned about the life of an Indian New York City cab driver?
Mm-hmm. The incredible networks. I've read about networks in immigration journals and other journals, but the incredible reciprocity among the cab drivers, that, and secondly, how insular the community is from larger America.
Hmm. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. On both of them or just one?
Well, specifically how they keep, I wouldn't say keep to themselves, mm-hmm. but I guess that is what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm. Well, their community, their friends, I don't remember any one person who did not have a Punjabi or at least, you know, a South Asian friend, but they were primarily, because they're coming in as networks and they're completely insular to the entire country, partly that's a function of, I think, the fact that, you know, they don't feel included, they feel isolated, they don't feel so comfortable with the culture, they also feel disrespected, you know, as poor people or working class people and as non-whites. So they are completely insular. And it's, to me, that was amazing because I obviously have a different experience living in this country as opposed to the taxi drivers. And here we are from the same part of the country, or, I mean, the same country, although different parts, and yet have such different experiences. And to me, it was a function of, I think, when I came, the people I met, the spaces that were that I was in as a result of the school I went to and the people I met. Whereas for this group of people, they were coming in to meet other friends, but also because of the socioeconomic background and who they were, there seemed to me to be a greater distance from the larger America. And I'm sure that that happens for the other classes of South Asians coming in as well, but I think for others, if you're, you know, working as a professor, or you're working as a computer specialist, so there's a greater contact as a result of the working space, so there's some interaction that happens. But for these cab drivers, they are working, you know, in their cab is their workspace, and they really don't have the opportunity to meet other people, so they tend to become more insular as a result, at least that's what I think.
Well, I want to thank you, Aditi Mitra, for not being insular about this topic. What a lousy segue into the outro. I mean, it's outsular because it's bringing us to out of this segment. But I want to thank you very, very much, actually, for telling us a little bit about your life and about the life of the people that you've looked at and studied. And I want to wish you best of luck in teaching and continuing to learn from and with America. Thanks so much, Aditi Mitra.
Thank you very much.